The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is young adult novelist Julie Berry, whose books have found crossover appeal with adult audiences. Berry's books include the 2017 Prince Honor book and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize shortlisted novel, The Passion of Dulce, and All the Truth That's in Me, which was a finalist for the Carnegie Prize and the Edgar Award. In her latest book, Lovely War, she weaves a tale of Greek gods and four young lovers who find one another in the final year of World War I. Hazel and James, a classical pianist from London and a young soldier on the Western Front, and Aubrey, a black musician soldier in the Harlem Hellfighters, 369th Infantry Regimental Band, and Colette, a Belgian woman who lost her family in a German civilian massacre in the opening days of the war. Their story is narrated in a Scheherazade sort of fashion by Aphrodite, who must tell the story or face judgment in Mount Olympus. Despite that unusual narration device, Lovely War tells an interesting story of love in a time of war and tremendous loss that also touches on the history and the social and racial issues of the time. Julie Berry is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Julie Berry, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell us about the inspiration for Lovely War. Obviously, you wanted to tell a story about the Great War, but you used such an unusual device for telling this story. How did this book come about?
Well, I'd been interested in researching and writing about World War I for some time, and I began a sort of broad exploration just to try to understand the war better and figure out which parts of it I'd like to focus on. And I knew that I wanted to tell a love story set during the war, and I was interested in both the lives of women and soldiers during the war. Of course, there were a few women soldiers, not very many. There are a lot of women, though, who were key volunteers as medics and nurses and all sorts of things, ambulance drivers. So I was trying to figure out which aspect of the war interested me most and trying to hone in. And I found that in my research that the war was just so very broad, so vast, so far-reaching in its effect on the planet and on the lives of millions. There are very few people on Earth who were unaffected by this war. And so the more that I studied that, the more I struggled to figure out how to find the right perspective to tell the story. Because a love story, by its nature, is a very intimate look at the lives of two people. And I wanted that intimacy, but sometimes that comes as a trade-off for breadth, for scope. If you want to look at a wider war, you can't necessarily spend all your time just on two people, two young lovers. And so I began to think unconventionally, and I thought, what if love personified could be my storyteller? I thought, well, that's interesting, but I didn't think love personified was necessarily the storyteller of choice for a battle scene. And so then I thought, well, maybe I also need war personified to tell my story. And then I realized we already have love personified and war personified, and they're already secret lovers. And as soon as I realized that that choice was available to me, the rest of the story just took off. So that was really the missing piece. So some people have thought that because the story is told by Greek gods, and it's the story of two young couples who meet during the war, some people have thought that maybe the Greek gods were a sort of afterthought. But they were there from the very beginning because there really was no way to tell the kinds of tale I wanted to tell without those narrators. So Aphrodite and Ares are the chief storytellers, but also Apollo and Hades, and they tell the story of our two sets of lovebirds.
And it's very interesting having them as narrators, and of course, there's their own story involved with this, set some years later. But I want to talk about the inspiration for telling this story in this particular age, and I was struck by something you said. You know, World War I was this, you know, the war to end all wars. Of course, it wasn't, but it was also this huge epoch-changing event where you could really mark it before the war and after the war. I suppose World War II is similar, but not to the same extent. You had so much hardship before nearly all people involved before World War II with the Depression and everything else that happened before. But really, prior to World War I, it was a feeling within the Western world that things were just only going to get better and better and better, and this long time of prolonged peace might last forever. And all of a sudden, things absolutely changed.
That's certainly true. Nobody saw this coming, or very few, I guess you'd say. And, you know, certainly in Western Europe, it was, for the most part, an age of prosperity and peace. There was this sense of life being just, you know, tea parties and tennis on the lawn. Now, to be clear, we're talking about a certain very privileged class.
That's the upper class, yes. You know?
But you know, there had been a long reign of prosperity, of course, prosperity at the expense of colonial exploitation of other parts of the world. So, you know, we have to be very careful to remember who we're talking about when we say, you know, life was rosy. Life was very rosy for the middle and upper classes of Western Europe, and, you know, America was doing all right. So, yes, this cataclysm out of nowhere was very much a rude awakening after a relatively long period of prosperity and peace. But, of course, nations had been building up armies and building up armaments, and I won't get into, like, all the geopolitical factors that led into the war, because that's, like, a whole, you know, three-hour lecture in itself. But yes, nobody was prepared for the war at all. But when the war began, their notions of what warfare would look like were so minuscule and outdated. They, you know, this war began with people still riding into battle on horseback.
Right.
But very quickly, machine guns and artillery, missiles that had, you know, reached epic proportions in terms of their murderous ability, changed all of that. And the world had to rapidly adapt to the realities, the very gruesome and deadly realities of modern mechanized warfare. And no one was prepared for that. And the stories of the bloodbaths of the early months and years of the war, while generals sort of, you know, fixed in their old habits and their old thinking, refused to adapt, and that the needless slaughter because of it is just chilling. Classic example, the French love to wear their red trousers into battle, and they would not stop wearing red trousers because that's what it meant to be French. It was that esprit de corps, that, you know, that verve. And of course, you know, now you had rifles with 300 meter ranges and more, and so those red trousers were like targets, you know. And that's just one of many, many examples of how the world's militaries had not caught up to present technology and present thinking. So the loss of life was so tragic, so much more than it needed to be.
Of course, your story picks up in 1917, in the last year of the war, once the stalemate had been going on the Western Front for 3 years, fairly much, with just nothing but loss of life. So that beginning vision was long shattered by the time your story picks up.
That's true. That's true. And it was a very difficult choice trying to figure out where to enter this story. At what point in the war? Very tempting to start at the beginning and, you know, really look back at that shattered peace. And I think, you know, we touch on that a little bit. As I mentioned, there are two sets of lovers.
Yes, Colette's story begins with the beginning of the war, yeah.
Right. Colette's story, she's Belgian, and so she's sort of living in that serene little summer of 1914, falling in love, and then, of course, the Germans invade her town of Dinant. But for the most part, the action of the story, as you say, takes place in the final year of the war. And so, you know, that was a really hard decision to make. One of the realities is that I write books that are read by both adults and teens, and so I grappled with the question of teens in the war. Now, there were plenty of teens in the war. Kids would enlist at age 15, and, you know, volunteers were often very, very young. But by the time they'd spent any time at all in this war, they were no longer young. Like, this war robbed people of their youth and innocence in such a profound way. And I decided that the final year of the war gave me the best chance to sort of look at all the war's impacts and still have, you know, plenty of story drama, but allowed us to sort of get in and get out. I mean, it's just a long war, right? It's hard to stretch a story over 4.5 years. So that was, you know, the decision I arrived at. But I think the final year is certainly decisive and interesting one.
Well, you tell us an interesting story of your characters, Hazel Windicott and James Alderidge. These are, James is enlisting, you know, in the last year of the war. Hazel Windicott is a pianist, and as her father is also a musician in the orchestras of London, and the popular orchestras of London, and performing for vaudeville and that and the like. Mm-hmm. And what made you decide on these two characters?
Well, so I play piano. I'm not astonishingly well, but I'm an amateur, but I enjoy it, and I've played since I was a kid. And I really enjoy ragtime music. And so when I discovered in my research the connection between ragtime and jazz and the segregated African-American army divisions from the United States that traveled to France and sort of kindled that ragtime fever in Europe, I was completely mesmerized. And it just so happened that I had been working on learning a challenging ragtime piece when I started researching this book. And so I decided early on that I was going to learn a sort of body of ragtime piano and take it with me on tour as I went into schools and, you know, sort of perform little bits of ragtime for the kids. So that was fun. So I've always loved that music, and that aspect of history really fascinated me. Obviously, it has its sort of trauma as well. But I was looking for a main character, a young woman, and I wanted to explore some of the different things that young women did in the war. And, of course, the largest number of women volunteers were nurses or nursing assistants. And that's a fascinating field and something that, you know, deserves a lot of attention. I felt like in Testament of Youth, that experience with the VAD nurses really got a lot of play, and I thought it might be interesting to look at something that's talked about less, which were those entertainment volunteers, the people that went over and sang and danced and played instruments. A lot of young women are described as, you know, really wearing themselves out, dancing every night with, you know, one soldier after another. And I thought that's it's an interesting way to serve your country. So I thought that could be fun.
Well, you mentioned the regimental band that plays a role where one character comes from. This is the second group of characters, Aubrey Edwards. Mm-hmm. And you actually tell a real story from the war. It was the Clef Club Orchestra, which was a ragtime orchestra in New York. They enlisted en masse and became a regimental band that performed throughout the European theater. Tell us a little bit about that. How did you discover them?
Sure. Well, so I was researching, again, the war, and sort of all roads kept bringing me back to the story of the Harlem Hellfighters. And they certainly were not the only all-black division to serve and fight in the war, and they weren't the only ragtime band, all-black ragtime band, to distinguish themselves in the war, but they're perhaps the most storied group, partly because of their military exploits, but partly because their band leader, James Reese Europe, was such an important figure in music history in New York. And he survived the war only to be murdered by one of his own musicians shortly after the war. That musician is widely believed to have been a victim of shell shock himself. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of interesting. I view it as James Reese Europe was a casualty of the war just a few months after the fact because of the psychological trauma that it inflicted upon his men. But be that as it may, James Reese Europe, had he lived longer, I'm certain would have been a household name in the United States, along with other greats that would be part of that jazz age of music. He was a pioneer in organizing performances and orchestras and ensembles of all black musicians performing black compositions, which was less done at the time. And he, in fact, was instrumental in organizing a first ever, as it was called at the time, concert of Negro music at Carnegie Hall in, I want to say, 1912. But he was such an important figure, and he served with distinction during the war, was a second lieutenant. And their story is, I think, not told often enough, but of the stories of all black divisions in World War I, the Harlem Hellfighters sort of get the most play. And of course, that division also fought in World War II as well. So it was really interesting to explore the music and the service of James Reese Europe and his contemporaries during the war, and to write a fictitious character into their band and into their division. Aubrey Edwards, as you say, is not a real person. But in some ways, Aubrey's character allowed me to explore what might have happened had James Reese survived. So because of the centennial of the war, there's been a renewed interest in James Reese Europe. That concert at Carnegie Hall was recently recreated, and there have been some musicians really shining a light on his work and his compositions, which have been a lot of fun to see. It was really special to me, getting to explore that history.
My guest today is Julie Berry. Her new book is titled Lovely War. It's published by Viking. It's a story of love and loss in World War I, set against this interesting backdrop of the Greek gods telling this story. And I thought that was a really interesting choice. You said it was evolved from the beginning, but did you have any misgivings about telling the story from that perspective? Because it's such, it takes a reader sort of aback when you begin this story. Because you're expecting from, you know, the cover and everything about the book to be a story about World War One, and yet you're, you know, it's Ares and Aphrodite being caught by Aphrodite's husband, Hephaestus, and he sort of does this trial to determine if they're going to be guilty or not. And it's such an unusual device. Did you have any misgivings about using that way to tell the story?
I certainly did. When I first hit upon the idea, I thought, oh, they're never going to let me get away with this. But I started writing it, and it was just so much fun. It just immediately pulled me into the story. I just found myself giggling as I wrote it. And yet, at the same time, I was sure that they, whoever they are, I'm not even sure.
Editors, you know, people at the publisher, right?
Somebody, right? Somebody was going to say to me, you can't do this. You can't have Greek gods in a hotel room in World War II telling a war story about World War I. But then I just thought, well, why not? And so I wrote a bunch at the beginning, and then I think I did sort of talk myself out of it, and I sort of set that on hold for a while and tried to proceed with the story in some other way, and it just didn't work. And I found myself wishing that I could go back to the gods, and so I finally did. And that's sort of one clue that I look to as a writer. When things are working, trust them. If they're not, then you've got a problem to solve. But I found that when I was writing the story from the gods' perspective, I couldn't wait to get back to my work each day. And when I wasn't, it was a little bit more like work, you know, a little bit more like, well, I got to work on that story. So you have to trust those instincts at some point and say, it's going to be what it is. But there was a long period of time between sort of making that decision and actually showing it to anybody to get any validation that this was a good gamble.
Earlier, you were talking about Aubrey Edwards' character and how he comes out of this Clef Club orchestra and a regimental band that goes to France. And, you know, I was really struck by two things. One was, first of all, when you expect a band to go to Europe, you expect it to be functioning mainly as a band, as entertainment, but to find that they were actually fighting in the war, too, that was a surprise to me, but perhaps not altogether surprising considering the day and age. But also, you explore a larger issue and social issue that emerged from World War One was blacks coming to Europe and finding a new atmosphere, finding an atmosphere of less prejudice. And in the case of Aubrey and Colette, they discover one another, and there's an interracial relationship that's a part of this book. And it spells to a larger story that came out of the war.
Definitely. It was eye-opening to me to explore all of that history. And you know, I think we just don't talk about World War One enough. I think that that chapter of U.S. history at present gets sort of rushed through. You know, we kind of move all too quickly right from Civil War to World War Two in our collective consciousness. And so there was a lot that I had to learn in researching the book. And, you know, I've seen a couple of readers say online, well, you know, this interracial relationship feels anachronistic, you know, like I was trying to sort of put my modern wishful thinking into the past. But in fact, there were thousands of marriages between African-American servicemen who fought in World War One and French or Belgian women that they met overseas. And this in spite of the fact that the U.S. Army made it illegal for any black servicemen to even speak to a white woman overseas. So the context and the climate of racism within the U.S. Army and within Army leadership was quite sobering, quite staggering, and there's some really shameful aspects of that. I mean, obviously all of it is shameful, but there was, for example, a memorandum issued by certain U.S. Army commands to the French, because the Harlem Hellfighters Division was actually handed over to the French to fight alongside them. And that has its own, you know, bigotry at its core. But it turned out to be a good thing for the Hellfighters because the French command treated them with such esteem and respect. In any case, the American Army command was alarmed that the French were being so brotherly and friendly to the U.S. 369th that they wrote a memorandum explaining to them that blacks are inferior citizens and are, you know, viewed with distrust by whites, and that they should not be too friendly or too familiar, lest they spoil them and create expectations that would be intolerable to white America upon their return home. So, you know, it's just a sickening chapter in U.S. history, and a real look at those years of lynching and Jim Crow, and how that white supremacist sensibility affected the experience of black servicemen who largely enlisted to demonstrate their commitment to their country and their worth, their manhood, their integrity and discipline and courage, and instead were treated with such malice. And you know, obviously, I touch on this in the book, but there were numerous acts of lynchings and violence and murders of, you know, black servicemen by white American servicemen. So it's a galling chapter for sure.
And indeed, and you know, you were talking about hundreds and thousands of black servicemen that found Belgian and French brides. Many of them never came back to America, or only came back to America briefly and went back to Europe.
That is true. That is true. It was a really tough dilemma, I think, for black servicemen who, you know, had their families back home and would have liked to return to America, and yet the climate in America was much more hostile than in France toward black people and toward interracial marriage. So many returned with their war brides, but many stayed.
My guest today is Julie Berry. Her new book is titled Lovely War. It's published by Viking. It tells the story of two couples in World War I, Hazel and James, and Aubrey and Colette, an interracial relationship between Aubrey Edwards and the Belgian Colette, two English lovers who find each other. And a part of the book is written in epistolary form, where you're two lovers are sending letters to one another. Did you read many letters during that time to get a sense of what these young people would write about?
You know, that's interesting. I did not find a lot of letters. I did listen to a lot of firsthand accounts from people who lived through the war. The British Museum did a marvelous audio history project back in the 1970s when many World War I veterans and survivors were still alive, and so they recorded them telling their stories and sharing their memories of the war, and these archives are available. There's actually an audiobook that you can purchase and listen to these war survivors telling their stories in their own words, and this is Englishmen and Frenchmen and even Germans, men and women, all telling their experiences from the war. So that I found to be just irreplaceable. As I listened to people talk in their own words about their experiences, it put a whole different color upon my research. And I'd read a lot of autobiographies and memoirs written by people who lived during the war, and those were incredibly helpful. But there was something about listening to everyday people talk about it, the kind of persons who might never become a writer, let's say, but still had a great deal to tell, and to hear their own tone of voice, they felt so very real. They felt in the room with me, and I think sometimes when we look at the past and we look at old, grainy, black and white photographs, we imagine that the people who are removed from us by time are somehow not as real as we are today. There's something, quite literally, there's something about color photography that makes a huge difference. And I think
there does.
We feel removed from the long ago past if we can't see them in living color. So to hear their voices, they sounded like people I know right now. They didn't sound like fossils from antiquity. They sounded entirely real, and that was hugely moving to me. So I didn't read love letters. I wish I had, but I felt that I was able to get to know these people in these other ways, which was helpful.
The reason I asked was because the letters seem charmingly innocent. I don't know if that was because you're thinking of some of your readers, the young adult readers that would be reading this, or was that the sense you had how relations developed back then?
I mean, I think, you know, over the course of a global war, right, there would be a range from charmingly innocent to, let's say, not so innocent. There were all kinds of behaviors that happened with all kinds of people. But certainly these two, this pair, James and Hazel, I felt were very innocent, very sweet, very young, and very inexperienced in matters of love. And were it not for the war and the sort of urgency that it created, these two not only would not have met each other, but probably would not have dared to allow their initial acquaintance and feelings for each other to progress at all. But there's something about the war that stirred life up and made everything come into sort of sharper focus. And this was an age in, you know, the Edwardian period where young ladies and young gentlemen did not just meet and strike up an acquaintance at their own pleasure. This was an age of chaperones and very structured, brokered introductions by the adults in young people's lives, and all sorts of questions of appropriateness and suitability would be vetted by adults before any two people ever danced a dance, so to speak. So it was the war that sort of scrambled all those certainties and created a lot more independence for young people to make some of their own romantic choices, much to the chagrin of their elders, I'm sure.
I'm struck by a line from a John Borman film about the Second World War, in which the parents say, you know, war makes the young grow up very, very quickly.
It's true. And the older generation would have liked to manage that process a little more than they were able to during the war. They had to let go of some of those controls.
What's been the reaction to the book so far?
Well, I've been extremely pleased with the reaction. What's most meaningful is the really personal aspect, the things that people have shared with me as I've been on tour. For example, there was a woman who told me that her son served in Afghanistan and that when he came home, he couldn't talk about it. He couldn't share with her what his experiences had been like. And she came to one of my signings. It was in Northern California. And she said, "I want to thank you for this book because I never understood my son before I read this, and now I understand better why he couldn't tell me about his experiences." And that just shook me. I'll never forget that encounter. And things of that sort, other families who've had servicemen overseas come to me to say, "You understand." And I'm so moved by that because that was what I was hoping to do. You know, I was hoping to study and render that experience of serving our country in an honest and realistic and sensitive way. So that response has meant a great deal to me. And then, of course, a lot of readers just really respond so warmly to the love story and to their new understanding, which I hope the book has given them, of the plight of African-American servicemen and their families who sacrificed so much more for the courageous choice to serve their country and on all that they risked. Hearing readers respond to that, really, to me, it has seemed like a very glowing response for the most part. That has meant the world to me.
Well, Julie Berry, it's been a wonderful read. The name of the book is Lovely War. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Novelist Julie Berry speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her latest book is titled Lovely War. It's published by Viking. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests or commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa and you can search our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.